take long to cook. He had enough dough to make 4 pans of bread, 2 for this meal and 2 for lunch or supper. In the new world of finite fuel and materials, he always utilized a hot oven for multiple baking. Emily went to the cabinet and pulled out a box.
I'm going to make some brownies, as long as the oven is on and we have eggs.
Homemade brownies? Now I understand why you don't want to leave this place. John was excited for the food. He had electricity and fish in Charleston, but he had not eaten fresh eggs or bread in months. His family survived on rice, pasta, and fish. He was also excited about the fresh goat's milk, relegated to non-dairy powder for his coffee since the pandemic. When Matt stumbled down the stairs, there was a bounty on the table of eggs, fresh bread, milk, and coffee. He was happy to enjoy the feast, but less enthusiastic when he learned one of the house rules. Last one up does the dishes. Brian, on the other hand, was excited Matt was in the house, as he was consistently on breakfast dishes duty. The day went according to plan. Lots of playing, catching up on stories from the winter, and decompressing from the previous 6 months. Matt returned to the role of kid, enjoying games with his younger brother and cousins. The Dixons ate a late dinner. Jay, Brian, Craig yawned before finishing their brownies. 15 minutes after the brownies, they were in their beds fast asleep. Emily tucked the children into bed and came down the stairs in comfortable pajamas and a robe.
We have 3 very tired boys upstairs, she reported to the group.
That was a great day, Aunt Emily. Thank you.
Matt put a log onto the fire in the living room and sat down next to it.
You were talking about planting crops at the local Y?
Matt restarted a conversation from earlier in the day.
Yes, there's a fence around this huge open space at the Y just down the road. There are 2 levels, probably 4 or 5 acres. We could use a tractor to plow this spring, get crops into the ground, and it's close to the house.
Todd sat down in a chair in the living room with Matt.
Where's the water source? Is there a natural lake or something nearby? We can't rely on rain.
Matt asked questions based on his months of farm studies.
There's a reservoir pond that is pretty close, maybe 100 or 200 yards away, but it's down a hill. I don't know of a river or stream that's close.
Todd leaned towards Matt as he spoke.
A reservoir is nice, but it will dry up just as quickly as our crops if there's a drought. We need a natural body of water that will withstand drought, otherwise we risk losing all of our food in a matter of weeks.
If it doesn't rain during the month of July or August, and we don't water our crops, we're done. If we do use a reservoir, well, it needs to be above the crops so we can use aqueducts to move the water to the fields as needed. We can't use watering cans and walk 200 yards up a hill.
Todd nodded.
You're right, he said. You're right.
That field would work if we could guarantee rain all year. But if we get 3 weeks of no rain, done.
If we don't have a natural water source near here, I'm not sure we can live here, meaning this house. We can't risk losing water. Rain barrels won't keep us going if we have to use them for ourselves, crops we have at the house and the animals.
Okay, I got it. You're right. If we have a drought like we had a few years ago, when it didn't rain for about 3 months, 100 rain barrels won't keep us alive, let alone our crops and animals.
Emily entered the room with a glass of wine. She sat on the couch and listened.
We could get closer to Falls Lake or the Neuse River. Those are both large water sources to sustain our crops and livestock, Emily interjected.
John walked into the room, having cleaned the dishes after dinner.
We want a body of water nearby so we can drink it, hunt the animals that use the water, fish, and use the water for crops. Water is life.
Todd hunched forward in his chair to think.
If we're going to move from this location, which is a certainty after Matt's points, he smiled at his nephew, we should open our prospects to anywhere. Moving what we have a few miles is just as difficult as moving it 100 miles or even 1,000 miles.
It should be an established farm. There's no reason for us to dig up grass and prep soil. I understand that we'll have to clean up last year's crops, probably left unreaped, but that's easier than burrowing under grass.
John considered locations in and around Hanover that would work.
Matt, you know that farm your mother used to drag us to each year? The one with the cows? It was owned by some wealthy family or something like that. That spot would fit the bill for this year.
John, Todd started. The gasoline is going to be bad by the end of the summer. We have to be where we want to live permanently by the end of the year. If we set up crops at that farm in New Hampshire, it's with the long-range plans of living up there forever. If we want to move after this summer, it's probably by horse and buggy, or by foot.
There was silence in the room. Only the crackling fire's pops cut through the air. Hubba, enjoying a post-dinner nap in a corner, rolled over and farted. The adults laughed at the dog.
This isn't something we're going to solve tonight, or need to solve tonight. It's probably not a decision we're going to make without Paul and Hank.
Todd stood and stretched.
I don't know if tonight is the night we want to discuss our departure date for Hanover either. If it is, I'm okay, but if it isn't, we should discuss some short-term goals.
Todd sat back down. We, and when I say we, I mean Emily, have been homeschooling the kids. We don't teach them every day. We alternate lesson days.
John cut him off before he could continue.
We do the same with Craig. Matt is an excellent teacher.
They can be a little rambunctious, but as long as they're learning to read and write, well, I'm not worried about history and literature as much.
Emily turned to speak directly to Matt.
I work on reading and writing with Craig, but he's got both of those down well. I need him to learn math so he can help with farming and cooking. He doesn't need calculus as much as he needs basic survival math skills.
Matt explained his teaching strategies to Emily.
Good, Todd said. We can continue their education for the short term. John and I will figure out and acquire our necessary supplies. To be honest, we might leave here in 2 weeks and find that we cannot get to Hanover by road for another 3 months.
Emily, sensing a turn to the serious topics, steered the conversation back to the day.
What a fantastic day this was. Matt, you and Craig are a welcome breath of fresh air for our kids. Craig particularly being the right age to play. Thank you for being so patient and kind to your cousins.
Matt grinned.
They're fun kids. A little energetic, but that's okay. It's not like I have texts to return or posts to make to all my friends. The last 6 months have been weird, focusing on the people in front of me, rather than making sure people who aren't with me get messages.
Weird, huh?
Not weird at all, Emily replied. Not weird at all.
The families merged effortlessly, settling into routines over the next weeks. Craig, Jay, and Brian studied in the mornings and played until dinner. Matt and Emily traded off teaching and entertaining. John and Todd tended to the animals, hunted, and fished for fresh meals. Despite their comfortable lifestyle in Raleigh, there was constant discussion and preparation for their departure.
I know we've been over this 100 times, but let's walk through our trip one more time.
Todd and John ate peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in their newly acquired SUV. It was cool and raining outside. The temperature dropped to 53. A steady downpour of rain added dampness to the cold air.
Let's take 2 vehicles, a motorhome and a truck towing an animal trailer. We can use the truck to store fuel and food. We can stock the motorhome with food. We have to assume we can scavenge the rest of our needs along the way and when we get up to Hanover.
It was almost as if John was reading off a script, he replied so quickly. We tow a flatbed behind the motorhome with a small SUV in case we run into trouble with the other vehicles. We can get 400 to 500 miles on its fuel tank alone, which is a nice safety net. We would set the animals free, and hopefully, albeit a bit cramped, get somewhere safe or to another vehicle in 400 miles of driving. We'll take turns driving the RV and the truck.
John took a bite of sandwich.
When do we leave? Todd and John knew what to take to New Hampshire. They struggled with when to leave.
I say we leave on April 1st. We may catch an early spring thaw and get through on the roads. We have to decide which way to go. Do we hit the major cities or do we use a rural path and risk going through the New York and Pennsylvania mountains?
The men debated their route over and over, never settling on a decision.
The mountains could bring snow and potentially strand the vehicles or cause them to crash. Washington, D.C. and New York had potential bridge outages and confrontation with survivors. Do they take the rural route and avoid survivors? Or do they embrace the idea of engaging other people by driving through major metropolitan areas?
Emily wanted to find people and other tribes, as she called them. She pointed out severe weaknesses of their current tribe. They had no doctor. If any injuries, something as minor as appendicitis, befell the group, they did not have the skill set to survive. Their group was missing women. Emily was spoken for, and Todd had a vasectomy. Perpetuating the species was not going to happen in their current makeup. They needed children and laborers to help sustain their families. She cried at night while talking to Todd.
Will the world end up being Jay and Brian, and then the one of them left? Wandering the earth as the sole human survivor? How pathetic and sad a fate we could be leaving our two children. We have to find all the other people in the world and start a village. We need to maximize what's left of the human potential to create a better place to live and a better future for our boys.
Emily wanted grandchildren and hope for a future. She talked about finding engineers and inventors that could create a village with electricity, lights, and technology. John and Todd were wary of finding other people, particularly an evil person who might kill or hurt a member of the family. They were afraid of picking up a lazy freeloader who would not carry their weight, yet use resources. What could they do after a person was part of their village? Kick the person out in the cold to die? They had few options once they found people, so it was best to not find people at all. Who would be in control of a village? Would there be a person who suddenly had control over the water, the food? Could the Dixons be subjugated to workers? John and Todd's outcomes were negative and bleak, but they were not unrealistic. Having a doctor would be nice, and finding women and children would be great. But at what risk? The adults, including Matt, debated until late into the evenings. What future did they hope to bring to the world? What future did they hope to bring to themselves? Matt sided with Emily and was vocal about finding other people. He wanted people his own age, if possible, or at least within a decade of his own age. He wanted people with different skills and different abilities, and he knew he needed more hands to work. As his father, aunt, and uncles grew older, providing for the family would fall on him and the younger kids. John was steadfast. He did not want outsiders in their group. He did not want to cede power to anyone. He wanted to live his life his own way. If he had to yield to a vote by his brothers and Emily, he could live with that decision. But yielding to a group of outsiders was not part of his plan. Outsiders meant the creation of laws, and laws had to be enforced. John raged endlessly against this new tribe Emily wanted, and ranted about the perils of creating a new society. Todd was the deciding vote. He understood Emily's logic about wanting a physician in the group. A healer was a necessary function in any working society. If they could find a doctor, the doctor could train one of the kids, handing down knowledge for the future. Todd understood Matt's argument about his future, his society. He could empathize with John's fears. But Todd felt the fears were overridden by the needs of the group. The benefits outweighed the risks. Todd and John sat in the truck, rain streaming down the windshield.
I vote for going up through Washington, D.C. and New York. We'll bring the Suburban to tow the animals, not a flatbed truck. If we find people, we'll let them ride in the RV.
This was the first time Todd voiced his new opinion to John. There were probably 30 to 40 million people between us and New Hampshire. I bet we find at most 10 survivors, maybe less. If we find 50, well, we find 50. They can join us or stay where they are. But we need to grow our group, John. I know you're against it, and I get your reasons. But I'm voting with Emily and Matt. I'm voting for Jay, Craig, and Brian's future. For wives for them. For lives for them past our deaths. For grandchildren for you and me. I'm voting with hope.
Todd was overly dramatic in his speech, and he knew it, but he wanted to make John comfortable with the decision, a decision which was now final.
I get it. I understand. And I support the group.
John cleared his throat. He understood the decision, and wanted to make it himself, but he was afraid of who they were going to find on their travels.
If we find 50 people, and even 40 of them are like us, we're making the right call. I want this new society we're creating, this new tribe.
He cleared his throat again, turned, and looked at Todd.
I will say this to you, and I'll say it to Paul and Hank. If we take on new people, and they're good, hard-working, decent people, I will be the happiest man left on earth. If my boys can find partners for their lives and have children of their own, well, it's worth it.
John looked down at his feet and then back up at Todd. If any of the people we hook up with are bad, and they do anything bad, I'll kill them.
John let it sink in. I'll kill them if they even have the smell of doing something wrong to my family.
Playtime ended when the world died. Anyone who enters our group earns their keep. If they don't, I take care of it.
Jesus, John. You don't have to go crazy on me here.
Todd was taken aback.
No, don't get squeamish on me. Know the decision you've made. I think it's the right decision, but understand I have your back, and Emily's back, and Matt's, Jay's, Craig's, Hank's, Greg's, and Paul's backs. I will take out any problem we have, and I will do it without hesitation. We don't live in a world of hesitation any longer. We hesitate on where we should live, we die. We hesitate on when to plant, when to harvest, what to plant, we die. I won't hesitate on eliminating threats.
They sat in the truck, listening to the rain coming down on the roof. They stared at the lot of RVs, deciding which one they wanted to take, waiting for the rain to stop so they could see which ones had fuel and would get back to the house.
If we find any New Yorkers, they better goddamn not be Jets fans. This is a New England tribe, and I'll be goddamned if I will hear stories about the Jets. If someone stands up and has a green football jersey on, we keep rolling, doctor or not.
John used the same tone, but was obviously joking. At least, Todd thought he was joking.
John, it's a good idea, stopping for people. I know you focus on the negative scenarios, but think of the upside. If we find a mechanical engineer, an electrical engineer, a person who can get some of the power working, a doctor who can save the kids, set a broken leg, I think there's tremendous upside.
John held up his hand to stop his brother.
Todd, I know. It's the right call. You're making the right decision. I agree with you 100%. I just want you to know, you don't have to worry about the negative aspects of this decision. I will take care of it. I hope I don't, but I will. And I won't lose sleep, and I won't bat an eye.
They sat for another half hour, eating their sandwiches and talking about where to live. Neither of them brought up the conversation again. When the rain did not stop, they decided to find an RV regardless of how wet they got. They tried four different homes on wheels before settling on a giant $400,000 diesel with every bell and whistle available. It boasted the most horsepower and could tow a small SUV without a problem or additional loss of miles per gallon. They attached a car platform, and John drove the behemoth back to the house. Todd followed in their SUV.
Emily was ecstatic about the new RV. It was beautiful and provided all the comforts they needed for a potentially long trip north. She also agreed with the April 1st departure. She began to move supplies into the RV immediately, taking stock of its storage capacity.
The RV was incredible. There was a bedroom in the back with a king bed, perfect for sleeping three to four at once, as long as two of the people were Jay and Brian. There was a sleeper sofa and another full sofa in the living room area.
If they brought blow-up mattresses, they could sleep seven comfortably in the giant rolling house. There was a kitchen with burners for purifying water and cooking meals, and an oven for baking. There was a large television with a DVD player,
The RV had the potential of being more comfortable and entertaining with more utilities than their current house.
We should have moved into one of these months ago, Emily said after inspecting the vehicle from top to bottom. I've got a month's worth of food in there already, and we still have tons of storage.
Jay and Brian are filling the water tanks with bottled water, and Matt is taking care of the non-potable tanks with the water from the rain barrels. We'll be ready to go by March 15th, and definitely ready on April 1st.
Aye, aye, Captain, Todd replied in a sailor voice.
Emily gave him a look. You might find yourself sleeping out here sooner than April 1st if you keep that attitude.
I'll just keep the current home humming along. You get the rolling house prepped.
He gave her a wink and a smile. At the end of another long day, Craig, Jay, and Brian were in bed. Matt, Emily, Todd, and John sat in the living room next to a fire. The days were warmer, but the nights still had a chill. The fire was necessary and created a nice ambience.
I have a few requests, which might alter our timetable a bit, Emily started, catching the three men off guard. I'd like to make a few stops on the way up to New Hampshire. Sightseeing, if you will. I think it's important for the kids, Craig included, to see some of our nation's history. This might be our last opportunity.
The men were silent before John spoke.
What did you have in mind?
John looked over at Todd with a, really? You couldn't have brought this up sooner? Look.
Don't blame Todd. He had nothing to do with this. You two are concerned about roots and snow. I think about the kids. I want to tour the White House. I want to see the Lincoln Memorial and a few other highlights. We can even sleep in the White House.
That would be pretty neat, don't you think?
You realize we're bringing the chickens and goats, right? You want to spend a few days in D.C. with livestock in tow? John told her.
Yes, to both questions.
Emily did not back down. She seldom did.
This is it. Our last time in Washington, D.C.
You want to take the Declaration of Independence? The Constitution? Keep them as souvenirs?
We can. We can grab any art you want when we get to New York. Drop by the Metropolitan and take Monets and Van Goghs. Line our walls with them. But after this trip, we're done. We have no way to show our kids the Washington Memorial except through pictures. No way to show them New York City except in movies. This is not a joke from the crazy lady who likes to tour homes. This is a request from a mother who isn't going to have another opportunity to give her kids memories.
Emily's tone was serious.
I'd like to see that stuff again. I haven't been since I was like 7, Matt chimed in.
I haven't been since I was 21. I'm in too, Todd said in support.
Hey, John, we can stop at the Meadowlands, pick up some Jets paraphernalia, whatever you want.
You're hilarious, Todd. Just hilarious. John waited a second before responding.
I have to admit, you make a great point. I doubt we can get up to Hanover this early anyway. Making some stops, grabbing some memorabilia is an interesting idea. We want to find survivors, and driving into the heart of D.C. and New York is part of the plan anyway. We might as well take the kids to the sailboat pond in Central Park.
Now you're getting into the spirit? I mean, let's not go crazy, make this a 3-week tour of the East Coast, but let's not pass up the opportunities we have during the trip.
Emily was excited by the acceptance of her plan. She thought about it months before, but was afraid to bring it up. Now that they had a house on wheels, stopping a few times on the way to New Hampshire was not a problem.
Are we going through Philly? She asked.
Their route was fluid at the moment, changing with each conversation.
Let me guess. You want to see the Liberty Bell? Matt joked.
They all laughed. John put it back to the group. If we want to hit cities, our current route takes us through Richmond, D.C., Baltimore, Philly, New York City, and going a little out of our way to hit Boston and specifically Hightower to see if Greg's there. That is just about every major city on the East Coast north of Charleston.
Todd nodded. I don't feel like we need to go out of our way to engage any more metro areas. My question is no longer how we are getting to Hanover, but rather how long are we staying in each city? Are we buzzing through Baltimore? Are we slowing down and blasting music or something?
What efforts are we making to find other people?
They thought about the question. Matt answered, I say we leave a week earlier than planned, and we make strategic camps in each city. I don't know how big Richmond is. Maybe we spend one night there. But we get up there, we light a fire, a big fire. We blast some air horns, maybe every hour. Then we pack up and leave the next day. Maybe D.C. is 3 days instead of one, and we move the camper each night to a different part of the city. Obviously, we could spend weeks doing this up and down the coast, but we don't want to delay getting to Greg, Uncle Paul, and Uncle Hank. We make sure we get to Hanover by mid to late April, and we make a strong effort to find people.
You're a lot smarter than most 17-year-olds, you know that, Matt?
Emily smiled at him. I might be the only 17-year-old in the world, but thanks. He smiled back. I feel like I have ownership of the plan to round up people, and I've been thinking about it for a while. You gave me the courage to bring up stopping in each city. As long as we're sightseeing, let's find people, too.
Is there anything keeping us here?
Todd asked. When no one had a good response, he suggested a new departure date.
Let's plan on leaving in a week.
Jay, Brian, and Craig were the most excited about the proposed adventure. They envisioned 2 days of boring drive time to New Hampshire. Now they had high hopes of meeting other people and seeing interesting things. Matt created a lesson plan for the kids. They made a trip to the library to check out books about New York and Washington, D.C. He talked to them about Camden Yard and Yankee Stadium. He showed them pictures of the mountains they were going to see. He had so many books about New York City, he began to get excited about the trip, too.
There's one big rule the three of you have to follow. It's the number one rule.
Matt and the parents had a lot of rules for the kids. Seriously, I have to follow this one, too, okay? Craig, Jay, and Brian nodded.
We're going to meet new people on this trip.
Matt paused.
Well, we hope we're going to meet new people.
Yeah, we know that, Craig responded. He was less in awe of Matt than the two younger kids.
Yeah, okay. Well, the one rule you need to follow, no matter what, you should never be alone with any of the new people. Ever. Don't let them get you alone. I'm not allowed to be alone with them either. We are always in pairs, and one of the pairs is always an adult. No exceptions. Do you understand?
What if the new person is a kid like us?
Are we allowed to play with the kids by ourselves? Brian asked.
Surely a kid was not off limits.
No. You always have one of us there. If you were ever caught alone, you're in big trouble. This is a dangerous trip. You need to stay with us. Never get alone with anyone other than your family. Never.
The kids nodded again. We're going to have a great time. Don't sweat the rule too much. We just want to make sure we all have fun and we all stay together. These cities are big places. We don't want to get lost. Stay with one of us, and you won't. It was the first conversation of many Matt and the parents had with the three younger Dixons. Taking on new people meant preparing for potential issues. John continued to have fantasies about encountering evil hordes of survivors. If we come across hostile gangs, people who were starving and want our vehicles and food, I'm just going to drive. We hop in the RV and the truck and we just drive, fast. Todd acted sincere when he listened, but he did not share his brother's bleak worldview. If his family, with a 6- and a 7-year-old, could survive comfortably, it meant other families or people probably did the same. He wondered if entire families survived like his and John's, or if people were one-off survivors like Paul and Hank. After one more week of preparation and planning, Todd was about to find out if there were any survivors. He, Emily, and the three young kids piled into the RV with Hubba. They pulled out of the cul-de-sac early in the morning. The kids watched a movie. Emily sat shotgun. Todd and Emily said goodbye to their house and neighborhood the night before. She turned to him as they pulled away.
This was a great place to raise our family. I'm sad that we won't ever see it again.
She doubted Raleigh would be their final location choice. It was too far from the ocean.
I liked it here. We
We had great friends and a great community. But it died last year. We'll build our life in a different spot.
John and Matt drove the SUV, pulling a livestock trailer filled with chickens and goats. It was only a 3-hour drive to Richmond. Emily made the commute several times a year for business. She recommended the museum district off the highway as their first campsite. The highway was empty. Todd feared bridges and overpasses would be destroyed, but they made an uneventful drive north on US 1, merging onto US 85 North, and again merging onto US 95 North, the road that would take them all the way into Boston. Emily pointed to their exit, and Todd pulled the behemoth house on wheels off the highway. He drove a few blocks into the suburb and came to a full stop in a town square. He laid on the car horn for a full minute. Hubba barked loudly. The kids held their ears and screamed. John and Matt were out of their car, pulling a metal trash barrel to the center of the street and filling it with debris. There were dead leaves covering the ground. The town was unkept and abandoned.
I don't hold out much hope. There are only 300,000 people in this metro area. The idea that we could attract the one or two survivors, well, it's a speck on a needle in a haystack.
John continued his role as group pessimist. Statistically, he was correct. There should not be a survivor in Richmond. Besides, if I lived here, I'd bolt for the Chesapeake as soon as I could. That's a much better resource for food than anything around here.
There's nothing that says we have to stay here an entire day. Let's light the signal fire, have a picnic lunch in this square, see if there are any supplies we can take, and move along this afternoon. We'll leave the fire burning and hang a sign with instructions to our next stop.
Todd knew they had time to burn, but having idle time did not mean he wanted to burn it sitting around the empty city of Richmond, Virginia.
I'll make some sandwiches, and we'll hang out for a few hours, Emily announced after listening to John and Todd's exchange. Why don't one of you blow an air horn a few times? Maybe 2 or 3 bursts in each direction. Throw some wet leaves on the fire.
She ducked into the RV to make lunch. Hubba stuck his head out, jumping down the steps. He waddled over to the center of town and used the facilities.
Todd turned to John. One good thing about the end of the world, no leash laws. And I don't have to pick up dog poop in public places.
John nodded, but did not acknowledge the weak attempt at humor. He walked a few paces and blew the air horn, holding the button for a 3 count. Hubba went crazy, barking loudly and beelining it back to the RV, up the steps and out of sight.
John blew the horn 3 more times. Thick black smoke rose from the trash can fire. Survivors had 3 hours before the caravan pulled out of town.
2 hours and 2 horn blasts later, the boys were playing soccer in the square, and the adults were peering into a few of the local shops. A car engine hummed in the distance. John yelled for the kids to get into the RV, and he pulled a gun from his waist. He ducked into one of the stores.
Emily and Todd walked towards the RV and saw a small red car driving towards them. They started waving in a friendly fashion, wearing big smiles on their faces.
Is your crazy brother really hiding with his gun pulled out, waiting to pounce on this person? Emily said through her smile.
I guess. It's not a horrible idea, but it's not the most welcoming approach either.
Matt's got the kids in the RV. I think we're a go.
Emily was nervous. Finding and engaging new people was her idea. She hoped it went well.
The red car drove cautiously down the road towards them. Emily could make out one figure in the driver's seat of the small luxury coupe. The car pulled up short of the waving Todd and Emily. A young woman rolled down the driver's window and stuck her head out.
Oh my God, you are actual people. Real people. I thought I was alone, but you are real people. Are you broken down? Do you need help?
The woman had a slight accent. Latino, Italian, or Spanish. Emily could not be sure. The girl had a dark complexion. Jet black hair, brown eyes, and was attractive. Emily and Todd decided if they met a woman or a child, Emily would engage. If the new person was a man, Todd would lead.
Emily stepped forward.
No, we're doing well.
My name is Emily Dixon, and this is my husband, Todd. There are 7 of us, and we're headed north to find family members. We're trying to find other survivors to join us.
It has been months since I've spoken to someone or heard another voice. The girl did not cry, but tears welled in her eyes. She gripped the steering wheel to maintain her composure. Emily continued, "We're nice, normal people. We even have a dog. Are you hungry? Would you like something to eat or drink? Again, my name is Emily. This is my husband, Todd. What's your name?"
The woman turned off the car and opened the door. She stood and fell into Emily's arms.
"I'm so lonely. At first I was scared, but now I am lonely and bored. I cannot believe you found me,"
she cried. Emily held her, patting her back and telling her, "It's okay, it's okay." Todd waved to the small faces looking through the windows of the RV. The door opened, and the boys spilled out with a barking hubba. The dog trotted to the new girl and sniffed her feet and legs.
"You really have a dog? I thought all the dogs were dead."
The girl was calm. She backed out of Emily's arms to bend down and pet the dog. Hubba was indiscriminate about scratches. He sat and enjoyed the new person. He was panting from the short burst of energy displayed, jumping from the RV and jogging to the new person.
"That's Hubba," Jay the chatterbox told her. "He's the first dog of North Carolina. My mom rescued him from a mansion. My name is Jay."
The 6-year-old walked to the girl and stuck out his hand. The young woman stood and took Jay's hand.
"My name is Solange, but my friends call me Sol." She sniffed in her tears. "Because you are now my friend, you may call me Sol. Very nice to meet you, Jay."
Solange was young. 28 or 30 was Emily's guess. She was thin, with an athletic build, and normal height for a woman, maybe a little taller. Now that Solange stood in front of her, Emily realized the woman was not just attractive. She was drop-dead gorgeous. Solange turned to Emily.
"Nice to meet you, Emily. I'm sorry I lost control for a moment. I have been alone for a long time."
She leaned in to give Emily another hug and a formal greeting. Jay decided, since he was Solange's first friend, to introduce her to the group.
"Sol, this is my brother Brian. He's 7.
Jay held Solange's hand and walked her to the other children. Brian was shy when he met new people. He stared down at his feet and mumbled a soft, "Hello."
"He's kind of shy when he meets new people, but he'll warm up to you. This is Craig, my cousin. He's 10.
Craig shook hands and said hello. Craig tapped Brian on the shoulder, said, "Tag," and ran off to play soccer. Jay decided soccer was a better option. He dropped Solange's hand and ran off, yelling over his shoulder, "And that's my cousin Matt. He's like 17 or something like that."
"Hello, Matt. Very nice to meet you."
Solange shook his hand and walked back to Todd and Emily.
"And very nice to meet you, Todd."
She leaned forward and hugged a surprised Todd.
"What a nice young boy you have.
Young boys, I should say." The introductions sent the group into a pre-rapture paradigm. Solange stood silent, waiting for the adults to speak.
"My brother-in-law John is somewhere over there, waiting to see if you're friend or foe. He's Matt and Craig's father and should be out at some point."
Emily was embarrassed, but believed candor was the best policy.
"I understand. In this new world, it does not make sense to be too trusting."
Solange spoke controlled and proper English.
"My full name is Solange Wright. I am an exchange student from Ecuador studying at VCU. I was enjoying my summer semester when the sickness began. I had no way to get home to my family. Travel to other countries was halted after Brazil. I had been living near the VCU campus. I had nowhere to go."
Solange shrugged her shoulders.
"I stayed in the dorm until it became cold. I hid from the police. When everyone was gone, I found a house and have been living by myself. I have plenty of food, and I'm excited to talk to you, to meet all of you. As I have said several times, I am lonely."
She wore jeans that were loose on her waist and legs, a gray T-shirt with gold VCU written across the front, and a long-sleeve flannel shirt, unbuttoned and hanging loosely like a jacket.
Do you know if your family survived? Do you know anything about Ecuador?
Matt stepped forward.
The internet stayed up longer than the phones, and I followed my family until they were taken by the rapture, or El Encantado, as we called it. My family, my parents, my two brothers, and one sister, all died. It is just me. It is why I stayed here. I really do not have a place to go. I waited to see if the government would arrive. It appears you have come in its place.
She smiled. Have you seen any other survivors? A voice said loudly from across the street. John emerged from the store. He walked up to the new woman and held out his hand.
Hello. I'm John Dixon.
Solange Wright. Very nice to meet you, sir. As you can see, I am not a threat. Just a young woman who has not seen a single survivor in months. I have driven around Richmond trying to find another person. I have not seen anyone.
Todd extended an invitation to Solange. Sol, if I can call you Sol, my family's been living in Raleigh, North Carolina for the last 7 years. John's been in Charleston, South Carolina for the last 10 years. We have two brothers that are meeting us in Hanover, New Hampshire this spring. John has a son who's trapped at a boarding school, much like you were trapped at VCU. We kept in touch with them until late September. We're positive they survived El Encantado. We're driving to New Hampshire, seeking out survivors and inviting them to join our group. We aren't sure we're going to settle in New Hampshire, but wherever we do settle, we'd be happy to have you join us. We have some livestock and plenty of food. We can stay in Richmond for a few days if you need time to consider coming with us. But we welcome you with open arms.
New Hampshire is cold, right? Very cold, she replied.
Yes, which is why we probably won't settle there. John and I grew up in Hanover. When we had to pick a meeting spot during the chaos, our families decided on a place we all knew.
I do not have to think about it. I would like to join your group, if you will have me. I will work hard to become a strong member. I do not have many belongings, but I would like to get my clothes and my family pictures. If you will give me some time, I do not live far from here. May I come back in a few minutes?
Absolutely. Take your time, we'll wait. Welcome to the family, Solange, Todd said with a smile. Do you need any help? Matt offered. I could come and help you pack and carry.
No, thank you, Matt. I can pack quickly on my own. I will be back shortly.
She turned and jumped into her beautiful two-door cherry red Mercedes-Benz. She slipped it into drive and sped away, much more quickly than she pulled up to the Dixons a few minutes earlier.
Matt, John said to his son, what's the first rule? Were you about to get in a car with a stranger? I know you haven't seen a girl in 6 months. But let's keep your head on, okay? He rustled Matt's hair.
I'm also counting that as a denied. So, ouch.
Matt hung his head with a smile. That was not a play to meet her, I swear. I was just trying to make her feel welcome to the group.
Uh-huh. Like you helped me pack,
or anyone else pack for this trip, Emily razzed. You just got sacked, player QB. Take a seat on the bench.
The adults had a good laugh at Matt's expense. Jay ran over from playing soccer.
Where's Sol? Is she gone already?
She'll be back. She's going to come with us, Emily told Jay.
Sweet! Hey, guys! Sol is coming with us! I call her on my team!
He ran back to Craig and Brian.
What do you think? John asked Todd and Emily.
I know my son's opinion. He looked at Matt with a smile.
Best case, outside of a person with needed skills, although we didn't ask her about engineering.
Maybe she's an electrical or mechanical engineer and can help us get things running again, Todd said back.
She has great taste in cars, Emily said. That's a good sign.
John looked down the empty street. I don't think anyone is that good an actress. But just in case, Matt and I will hide until she gets back. If she was a scouting party, we may be sitting ducks. She got all of our intel.
Intel? Emily repeated. Seriously?
John ignored the comments. Matt, grab a rifle and find a building on the other side of the square.
just until she comes back alone. Matt nodded to his father before walking towards the Suburban to find a rifle. John made his way to a new hiding spot on the square. Todd and Emily clasped hands and went to supervise the soccer match. Solange drove back to her house a half mile from where she had met the Dixons. When she arrived at her Cape Cod just off campus, she sat in the car and cried. She wiped her tears and ran into the house to pack. She stuffed her tablet into a brown leather purse, threw her clothes into a Louis Vuitton rolling bag, and jogged back to her car. Solange kept family pictures and videos on her tablet, charging it through the car's cigarette lighter. It was all she had of her family and country, aside from memories. Surviving a plague alone in a foreign country, unable to be with her family as they died, earned her this new start with the Dixons. They did not need to know about her past. "Adios," she said to the house, speaking in her native tongue when she was alone. Solange turned her music on shuffle and put on her earbuds. Kelly Clarkson sang Stronger. She sped back to her new friends, returning in under 20 minutes to her new life. Solange parked the car across the street from the RV. She slung the shoulder bag, pulled the roller from the passenger seat, and announced, "I'm ready." "You travel light," Emily smiled. "I like that." "I have all of my personal items on these." She held up the technology. "And I do not have many winter clothes. I have found that I can acquire new clothes wherever I go. I only bring essentials. I buy or take what I need when I travel." Emily assumed Solange was referring to a post-rapture lifestyle, but Solange used the same strategy before the rapture. She brought only the one suitcase and purse with her from Ecuador 10 months ago. "We believe the same. It's nice to see you have a head on your shoulders." John emerged from his sniper spot. He was impressed with the young woman. High praise, considering he was holding a gun on her just a half hour earlier. "I'll get the kids and we can head to D.C., Todd announced. He walked over to the park. "Kids, let's go."
"Is Sol back?" Jay asked excitedly.
"She is. I don't know if she's riding in the Suburban or in the RV, but she's decided to come with us." Jay and Brian ran towards the RV. Craig collected the ball and walked towards his uncle.
"She seems nice. Is she American? She talks funny."
"She's from Ecuador. That's in South America," Todd told him.
"Like Mexico?" Craig asked.
"Kind of, but not really. You know Mexico is in North America, right? It sounds like you need a geography lesson. Maybe she can help you learn more about Ecuador and South America." Todd took a step towards the RV and felt something soft under his foot.
"Nasty," Craig said.
He saw dog poop ooze from the sides of Todd's shoe.
"You have got to be kidding me," Todd muttered.
He held his profanity in front of Craig. Todd dragged the bottom of his shoe through the grass, attempting to get the crap off. The poop was embedded into the treads of his sneaker. John watched. "You know, people picked up dog poop so they wouldn't step in it themselves. It wasn't just a societal rule."
"Asshole," Todd said back.
Emily stood at the door of the RV. "You're not coming in here with those shoes. Find a hose and clean them off or throw them away, but that poo is not stinking up our home."
"These are my favorite shoes. You know they don't make them anymore," he pleaded, looking around for a hose. "No one makes anything anymore, Todd, and maybe you'll clean up after Hubba next time," she said.
"He's your dog," Todd muttered.
"Clean them or chuck them."
Emily shut the door on her husband. He heard a click as she locked the door. Todd walked towards a street of homes, hoping to find a working hose. These really were his favorite shoes.
"Where would you like me to ride?" Solange asked John. "In the house or in the truck?"
"You pick. I'm driving the truck. We have music and conversation. If you ride in the house, you can watch a movie or play video games with the kids."
"I would like to ride in the truck with you and Matt, if you do not mind," she asked politely. "I have been without adult conversation for 6 months. I like children, but I would like to talk, at least during the first part of our trip."
Solange walked towards the SUV with her suitcase.
"How long is the trip to New Hampshire?" she asked.
"We can get there in a day if there isn't any snow, and if we didn't have plans to stop in Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York City, and Boston," John said back, opening the door.
"Would you like to say goodbye to your car?"
He nodded towards the Mercedes.
"It is a car.
A very nice car, but a car. I will not miss it.
I enjoy people more than things," Solange replied.
"Sol is with us," John yelled. Todd waved back. He walked towards the RV in socks, holding wet but clean shoes. The tribe was one member stronger as it headed towards Washington, D.C.
25. It was February, and Hanover was cold. The snow had been on the ground for 3 months. It continued to snow each week, piling and drifting above the windowsills. Greg commented that it provided nice insulation against the wind, which howled most days. Rebecca was warm, dry, and well-fed, but she was stir-crazy. The weather turned on the two teenagers in December, becoming bitterly cold at night, and not much warmer during the day. Greg and Rebecca quickly realized they needed to get serious about winter preparations. They gathered large amounts of firewood and stored it just about anywhere they could. They filled the side porch at the front of the house as well as the upstairs bedrooms with wood. They filled the back of their van with wood and parked it next to the house for easy access. They knew the van would be useless once the snow flew. More wood filled the halls and rooms of the sorority next door, seasoned and dry when needed. Their chickens lived in a butler's shed at the back of the cottage. Rebecca created a coop by shredding newspapers, books, and computer paper in place of hay. The coop was warm despite the outside temps. It smelled bad, and Rebecca vowed to change the paper once a week. But the chickens did not mind the smell, and they continued to lay eggs. Rebecca and Greg found 5 other chickens during their first weeks in Hanover, and were back up to 11. They had more than enough food to get them through the winter, but Greg was obsessed with hunting fresh meat. He bundled up in as many clothes as he could and headed out with his shotgun a few times each week. He set traps in hopes of snagging smaller animals, and to his credit, he captured dozens of squirrels and other small game, giving welcome meat to stews and rice dishes. Greg could hunt for about an hour before his fingers and toes began to freeze. The snow was so deep he found it impossible to go far without suffering complete exhaustion. His typical hunt involved walking the half mile to the Hanover golf course and setting traps in the woods and running trails. Rebecca suggested he use a snowblower to clear the trail to the course. The trick worked perfectly. Greg blazed the path to his hunting area, leaving the blower under a tarp at the course. When it snowed, he trudged over in his snowshoes and used the blower to clear the path on his return trip. Greg was off on a hunting trip to the golf course, and Rebecca was washing clothes in the bathtub, when a high-pitched noise, like the whine of a dirt bike, hummed through the walls of the cottage. She rushed to the window and watched 2 people on snowmobiles move in front of her house before making a left turn down Choate Road. The snowmobiles dragged sleds with large packages. Rebecca was alone, and quickly considered her options. "What should I do?" she said out loud. "Get in clothes and make a break for a dorm, waiting for Greg to get back? Hide in here? Do I think they saw or smelled the smoke from our fires? Of course they did, or they will eventually. They're going to come back. I know they're going to come back. What should I do? Think, Rebecca." She was trapped. If she fled, her fresh footprints in the snow would lead anyone to her new location. Her best bet was to hide and hope it bought her enough time for Greg to return with his gun. If she stayed in the house, the only tracks out the door were Greg's. The snowmobilers might not search the house at all, believing the sole inhabitant was outside. She heard the whine again. It got louder as the snowmobiles came back in her direction. She did not look out the windows. She grabbed her heavy coat and ran upstairs to one of the wood storage rooms. While loading the upstairs bedroom,
Rebecca made a hiding place large enough for two people. She put a four-person dining room table against the wall at the start of the second row of wood. She stacked wood on top of the table and blended a panic spot into the five rows filling the room. She left a gap at the end of the rows on the far wall that was large enough for her small frame to squeeze through. If someone looked in the room, even peered over the top of the wood stacks, the rows appeared solid, concealing her hideout. She kept two bottles of water, unfortunately now frozen, and several protein bars in the hiding spot. She had a lantern, but did not turn it on. Half a dozen fleece blankets were folded neatly under the table. She huddled in her hiding spot. Her breath was visible in the cold upstairs. She was panting, nervous.
"Calm down, Rebecca. No one will find you. If you control your breathing, stop making noise, you're safe until Greg comes back."
She gained her composure. There was a loud knock on the door. She squeezed her eyes shut, hoping it would make the people go away. She knew the smoke coming out of the chimney meant they were coming inside the house. The outer door opened, and Rebecca heard feet stomping in the mudroom. The inside door opened, and a voice called out, "Greg? Greg, are you in here? It's Uncle Hank and Uncle Paul." Rebecca opened her eyes and began to yell.
"Oh, my God, you're alive! I didn't believe him when he said you'd be alive, and you're really alive!"
She shimmied out from under the table and around the wood stacks to run down the stairs. Paul and Hank stood in the vestibule, stopping when they heard a female voice.
Who are you?"
Paul asked. He was covered in snow. He wore a neoprene face mask, large ski gloves, and a black ski suit. He pulled goggles off his eyes to display a bearded and pink windburned face.
"My name is Rebecca. I'm a friend of Greg's. He's out hunting, but should be back soon. Oh, my God, you're both alive. Come in, come in. Shut the door. Get warm by the fire."
"Wait, who are you again?
Greg is hunting?"
Paul was dumbfounded. Hank pushed past his brother and into the house. He was cold and did not care about Paul's questions.
"My name is Rebecca. I met Greg in Concord on his trip from Hightower to here. We came to Hanover in November."
The men were stone-faced. They did not expect to find someone other than Greg, let alone a young girl. They stood by the front door, now shut, unsure of what to do next.
"I don't have cooties. You can come in and warm yourselves by the fire. I have some water boiling. Would you like tea or hot chocolate? I can make soup, too."
Rebecca switched into her no-nonsense, get-things-done mode. These were Greg's uncles. They were family. She needed to get them inside by the fire to warm up.
"Where did you come from?"
Paul relaxed and embraced the situation.
"Hi, Rebecca. My name is Paul. This is my brother Hank. We're Greg's uncles. Anything warm sounds great. But if you have chicken noodle soup, I'll take you up on that."
He started taking off his snow gear, gloves, hat, and suit.
"Is there a place I should put this stuff to dry? I hate to get the living room floor wet."
"I'll take them and put them in the kitchen.
The wood stove will dry your clothes quickly. Please take off your boots and leave them in the mudroom shoe bin."
Rebecca held her arms out to receive the snow-covered clothes.
"I can do it. Just show me the way."
Paul elbowed Hank, who was still standing near the door in shock.
"Nice to meet you, Rebecca. My name is Hank. Soup sounds fantastic. Lead us to the kitchen."
The men took off their boots before following the young girl. Paul and Hank looked around the living room. It was immaculate and tastefully decorated. Two sofas ran perpendicular to a warm fire, along with two comfortable chairs at the top of the formation facing the blaze. A coffee table sat between the sofas. A game of Monopoly appeared to be in progress. Hank looked right and saw the two beds, neatly made, in the bedroom next to the front door. Rebecca turned and said, "This way to the kitchen." The men followed her, going through the dining room, or the bathing room, as Greg and Rebecca now called it.
"Is that a bathtub?" Hank asked her.
"It is. We use it as a washing tub, too. Clothes, not dishes. We set it up next to the fire so we could be warm when we took baths."
The door to the kitchen was open, and the wood stove assisted in heating the rest of the house. The open door also kept the kitchen from getting too hot. Rebecca went to a cupboard and pulled down two cans of chicken noodle soup.
She casually grabbed a pot, poured the soup, and set the pot on the stove to warm. The kitchen was as clean and orderly as the rest of the house. Paul pointed to the rain barrel on the counter